coming up on today's show.
Freddie got fired, Fitzmagic in Foxborough, and a whole lot of other F-words to close out the regular season.
Hawk and I break down the longest list of potential head coaches you will ever hear.
Top five running backs, quarterback carousel, and why being an NFL coach is like cleaning a dirty diaper. Sometimes the dirtiest doo-doo is the one you don't see coming.
All of this and much, much more coming up on another special holiday edition of the Tomahawk Show.
Hey, y'all. This is Freddie Kitchens calling in. We're a disappointing loss, obviously. We're trying to focus on going 1-0 next week. Any questions?
I've had it! Had it! David Blau on the Browns a few weeks ago catching touchdowns in the end zone as a quarterback. We can't do anything! I hate you, RG3! I hate you!
My name is Pete. I'm a Browns fan living in Pittsburgh. Just heard the news about Kitchens and I feel nothing. This organization has taken my soul and my will to live. We fired another coach who sucks. Hooray! Please excuse me while I go Joe Hawk myself.
This is Chris in Brunswick, and there is only one solution to the Browns coaching search. The two-headed monster of Joe Thomas and Andrew Hawkins. Joe Hawk yourself.
Welcome, everybody, to the Tomahawk Show. I am your humblest of all co-hosts, Andrew Hawkins, joined as always by one of the top football players in the history of football, Joseph Hayden Thomas. This is a special Black Monday edition of the Tomahawk Show, our official sponsor for this episode, Black Monday. Joe, how you doing today, buddy?
It's a somber day for me. I've dealt with plenty of coaching executions on Black Monday during my career. And although there was several times in my career, I was happy to see the coach replaced because I felt like they were not the man to lead the Browns into the right direction to the Super Bowl, which we all know it's coming. It's eventually coming. It's right around the corner. But in this case, still a little bit somber, even though I think, as you guys all know, no spoiler alert here, the Browns have just let Freddie Kitchens go. And I think it's a good decision, but still, you always have like the human side in my head that, you know, you kind of feel for him as a man, and as a family man in his family.
We'll get to that in the dog check, so I don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole. But there is always like a weird feeling of hope after a coach gets fired, if you're on one of those teams. Because typically when you get to that point, the team has gone in such a direction, everybody feels the tension and how bad it is. And there's always that glimmer of hope and like wonder in between, oh, who's coming next? And could this be it? Will this mean something great for my career? And, you know, so that is really is a weird insight that I think a lot of people don't realize for the players. My question to you, Joe, is this, and clearly we're jumping right into the episode, like, F it. Do you have any good stories for, and when I say good, I don't mean like joyful stories, but good stories about when a coach got fired. What is your best when a coach got fired story?
Well, I'll say that when the Browns hired Eric Mangini, we brought in a bunch of guys from the Jets. And I'll never forget that they said, hey, you guys are going to hate playing for Mangini. He's going to make your life miserable. The day we fired him, we legitimately threw a team party to celebrate his being gone. And I'll never forget when Mangini got fired in Cleveland, he was not well-liked either because he did make every part of your life miserable. And we always used to say he has thought of everything from how the toilet paper is rougher on your butt to making your travel nightmare miserable to make your life as horrible as possible to try to toughen you up and instill discipline. And now that I look back, I actually look back very favorably and fondly on my Mangini years because while it was a nightmare and it was miserable and took years off my career, it did make me tougher in the moment. I think it did make me a smarter, better football player. But I will say that probably just the biggest memory that I have is the night we did fire Eric Mangini. Some of the offensive linemen came over to my house and we ended the night after a few pops and Alex Mack was in our basement and he was ripping phone books in half. And it was foggy at that point of the night. He's got really big, strong hands. And so the next morning, I remember going back downstairs and not remembering what kind of happened that night and just seeing like a mound of torn phone books on my floor in my basement and thinking, what kind of dinosaur was hanging out with me last night and drinking all my beer and ripping all my phone books. For all you kids that are under 30, the phone book was this thing that they used to give you for free on your front doorstep that had a list of all the businesses and all the people in your area. And you could look people's phone numbers up in the phone book. And so nobody has the skill of ripping phone books anymore because, well, there's no phone books.
No. And also, I don't think they make humans like Alex Mack. They only make one every like 10 years. So mixed up in all of this, Joe, it was Christmas, man. Mm. There was Christmas since the last time we've gotten together to do an episode. What did you do anything fun? You got any good like good cheer to bring to this episode? Because it's going to need it. There's going to be a lot of wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, a lot of wah-wahs.
Sound effects they're going to put on the back end of this episode.
It is always a kind of an interesting time of the year because at the end of the season, people are missing the playoffs, coaches are getting fired, and it always happens like right after Christmas when it's supposed to be the happiest time of the year. So for me, Christmas was great this year. I did my Saturday calling the Bucks Texans game and then had a nice little stretch where I didn't have to do anything from a TV perspective. And so it was great. I got to go up to the in-laws place up in northern Wisconsin. They had like 2 feet of snow. And so we went sledding and built a little snowman and kind of had fun with that. And then this weekend celebrated with my parents at the farm and it was like 65 degrees. And so we were running around in shorts. So it's been an unusual Christmas, but really fun to always get together. And the happiest thing is that I get to talk with Hawk on Sunday and he's not in a hospital bed. So Hawk, it seems like the bird flu has ravaged you and it's left your body now. It's gone back over to Asia and left you a better man.
It tried to kill me off. It couldn't work. It wouldn't work. It didn't work. No, but it actually got worse since the last episode. It was a rough holiday season for your boy, Joe, because I flew family out to L.A. So we did Christmas in Los Angeles this year. No snow. Didn't matter because there was no snow back in Ohio anyway. And so my family's here. And for like 4 days, I was just laying face down in the fetal position, sobbing. Because I couldn't get over these flu-like symptoms.
Man.
And yeah, my throat hurt. I couldn't talk for like 3 days. I was coughing up a lung. Mm. I had the chills. My temperature got up to like 144. Mm. But yeah, I'm back now, brother. And my family is gone. They're like on flights away out of the city. And now things are back to normal, you know?
So do you buy Christmas gifts for your kids or do you let Keisha do that?
Keisha does the majority of the kids, Christmas shopping. And by majority, I mean all of it, ever since they've been born. I don't think I've picked one. Like it's always a surprising moment on Christmas when they open it up because they're surprised at what they're getting. I'm surprised at what they're getting.
You're like, wow, that was a really good gift idea. Really? There is really a Santa. I didn't buy that for you.
What was your kid's favorite gift this Christmas holiday season?
You beat me to the punch. My only son, Jack, he got a racetrack, Hot Wheels racetrack called Colossal Crash. And it's actually pretty cool. He's just starting to get that age because he's 3 and a half right now where he's starting to enjoy toys that I kind of like too. So him and I on Christmas, I got to set it all up. And we went up there and we played Colossal Crash with his Hot Wheels for a while. So basically, it's a big figure eight racetrack. And in the middle, the cars like go run past each other, right? And on the same track. And so it's only a matter of time before they like crash into each other and explode and the cars go flying off the track. So we bought him 12 little Hot Wheels cars and then we got him this track and it's got batteries and little wheels on the side. So it just keeps propelling them around until they crash. And then it's got two little jumps on it, which is really cool. So you can either turn the jumps on or off. So the cars can actually like jump over the top of each other. And so he sat up there for like an hour just watching these things go around the track and it was pretty cool. And so, I'm looking forward to the future. I'm looking forward to like when he turns about 10 or 11 or 12 maybe, and we can get him a PlayStation or whatever the video game console is then. And I can get into like
10, 11, 12
shooter games. Cause we played, GoldenEye. That was the big cool game when I think I was in middle school or whatever, or high school, on N64. And then I always loved Madden. Always loved college football, NHL 93, which is way, way back when the track and field game on Nintendo.
NHL 93 was sweet. Yeah. I remember that. 10, 11, 12 for video games. That's a little late.
Well, I think Well, I think that's when he's really going to get into it, you know, because that's kind of, for me, what I remember really getting into those games where I'd go down and I'd try to play a whole season of Madden over Christmas break and win the Super Bowl. Right. And it'll be a great excuse for me to go hang out with the kids a little bit and go play video games with Jack. How about
My son is super into Madden and has been for like a couple of years now.
Yeah, he's like a savant, though. He's going to be the Browns' next offensive coordinator.
He's writing down the playbook plays. So my kids' favorite gifts, I have obviously my twin 4-year-old daughters. One was a JoJo Siwa.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, carry on.
My girl's got a JoJo Siwa concert ticket too, and I didn't know what that was.
Yeah, no, it's so JoJo Siwa, they got multiple things. I think she got a robe, she got a pair of socks, and carry on luggage for JoJo Siwa, who is like some 12-year-old pop star that only girls under the age of 10 know. and then my other daughter got, what did she get? Maybe a kitchen. She wanted a kitchen with all the fake food, and like it's literally more food than I actually have in our real kitchen. And then my son had two favorite gifts, and this is going to be blasphemous to people listening to the podcast. Joe, if you can guess what one of my son's favorite gifts was. One of them was Cleveland Browns checker game. Okay. So my son probably got about, we capped the Christmas gifts. My son's getting at that age where like toys aren't cool to him anymore. It's weird. It's sad. It makes me want to cry. Mm-hmm. Cause he's like, Dad, I just want cool clothes and shoes for Christmas. So he had like a bunch of like, yeah, it sucked, man. So of his, let's say we got him 10 gifts. 6 or 7 of them were Cleveland Browns gifts.
Okay.
If you can guess what his favorite was of the other 4, I will Venmo you $7,000. You get one guess.
And of the non-Cleveland Brown gifts.
Of the non-Cleveland Browns gifts.
And how much are you going to Venmo me?
$7,000.
$7,000. Wow, a lot of pressure here.
Yep. One for every win of your career.
Thank you. Well, you must be a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. They really came after me this weekend, by the way. I'm not sure if you saw that on Twitter. Yeah. But anyways, I'm going to go with, it was probably like a soccer ball or something like that.
Nope. Yep, you missed out. It was a Lamar Jackson jersey.
Damn, should have guessed that. That would have been my next guess. I give him a lot of respect. Lamar Jackson is the most likable quarterback in the NFL right now.
Yeah, he really is, man. It's hard to root against the dude. I mean, it won't last forever. It never does. Am I right? Like, it's always. No.
Well, look, Patrick Mahomes last year, right? He was the hot thing, and he had a great season this year, but he's just like on the back burner right now because of how amazing Lamar Jackson is and how popular he is. And so there's always like the ebb and flow of a career. You know, nobody's just great forever. Nobody's the most beloved quarterback in the NFL forever. Look at Tom Brady. Yeah. People are talking about him being dead a year after he won the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They're acting like nobody likes Tom Brady and he can't win a game anymore. And they're 12-4?
12-4, man. We're going to talk about that too. And okay, so listen, check us out on YouTube as well, on Uninterrupted YouTube page. All of our episodes are up on YouTube. We're going to talk Tom Brady, but we're also going to hit the Browns game, the Freddie Kitchens firing, and all things Cleveland in dog check, as you would imagine, because we know that's why you came. But first, we got to hit the Tom of Headlines.
This is a special report from Tom of Headlines.
All right, Joe, so in an upset, Ryan Fitzpatrick and the Miami Dolphins beat the New England Patriots in Week 17 matchup, a game that was huge for New England. And for the first time since, I think, 2009, as a result of the loss from the Dolphins, they will not get a first-round bye in the playoffs. What does this mean for the Patriots' chances at a Super Bowl this year?
This means that the Patriots will repeat as Super Bowl champions.
What?
Because let's hear me out here, okay?
All right.
So think about the season that the Patriots had when they almost had the perfect season, right? They played really hard. They always put their guys out there right till the bitter end. Belichick always makes them play and practice. There's no rest ever. And that's typically when they get the best out of those guys. The fact that they lost going into the playoffs, Belichick is one of the best coaches of all time coming back after a loss, and his win-loss percentage is like astronomical. So when you lose in New England, as you would know, because you went through a lot of this,
yeah,
they make your life absolute hell. And that just for some reason brings those guys together. It just ratchets it up, their attention to detail. And they're going to go in and they are going to dog stomp the poor Tennessee Titans in that wild card game. And in the NFL playoffs, it's all about momentum. And then that is going to be able to build that momentum. And I think they're going right to the Super Bowl and they'll be able to win the Super Bowl. And it's all because of how they finished the season with that humiliating loss to the Dolphins at home.
But my question is this. The last time they had to play in the wild card round of the playoffs, I think they lost to the Baltimore Ravens. They've never, since then, it's been 10 years, and this is an old team. They needed a week off for their bodies to recoup, and it's not like they just lost to a playoff team. It's not like they just lost to a talented team that underachieved. They lost to the Miami Dolphins, a team that early in the season we were questioning, would they go 0-16?
No, it's alarming, but people forget Ryan Fitzpatrick is a really good quarterback when he wants to be. He's the Jameis Winston of the AFC right now because he's the guy that he might win a game against the best team in the NFL because he can go off and he can have just tremendous hot streaks. And right now he's on a hot streak. And so that's why everyone was wondering, like, if the Dolphins are really trying to tank, why are they playing Fitzpatrick? Because he's going to go out and win you a fair amount of these games where you're just completely overmatched, but he just goes off and looks spectacular. And that's just what happened today.
All right. I'm going to say it's going to hurt their chances. I think it almost eliminates them from going to the Super Bowl. And I might eat these words. Wow. And I get betting against the New England Patriots is not something you want to hang your hat on, but they got to face the Tennessee Titans, the red hot Tennessee Titans, the red hot Ryan Tannehill, who has a passer rating of over 100, has been playing lights out for them. Had they made him the starter since day one, they might be 13 wins deep this season. And not to mention Mike Vrabel, who is a former New England guy, who I'm sure will be up all week salivating. Like, this is a big game. This won't be just a rollover win for the Patriots if they do indeed win. From there, they got to go face, who do they face? Would they face the winner of the Chiefs? They basically would, they would go play Kansas City on the road. So they got to go play Patrick Mahomes and the explosive Kansas City Chiefs on the road, a team they already lost to. And if by some miracle they then beat them on the road, they got to go on the road against either the Ravens or, I'm going to call it now, the Texans are going to beat the Bills. And so they're going to have to play either Deshaun Watson and the Texans or Lamar Jackson and the Ravens on the road, two more teams that already beat them this season to get to the Super Bowl. I just don't see it happening.
A loss always galvanizes the New England Patriots and Tom Brady. They're going to be extremely motivated. They're going to be attention to detail 100, knowing that this is Tom Brady's last season. This is his last hurrah. This is his last run at another Super Bowl. And I just think that the way they got humiliated, it always brings the best out of the Patriots, and you're going to see that in the playoffs.
All right, so the Packers clinched the first round bye with a come-from-behind win against the Detroit Lions in Week 17. Now, again, with the bye, and this is a team who we, you know, we'll talk about a little later with LaFleur, and we talk about the coaching changes going on, but he's a guy who has come in and put Green Bay back on the right track. Are the Packers a legitimate threat in the NFC to win the Super Bowl, Joe?
They're a legitimate threat, but I'm not saying that they're odds-on favorites at all. I think the way that they've been winning razor-thin margins here is not sustainable, especially in the playoffs. They're going to have to run into some really good and talented teams in the NFC, and they can't just rely on coming from behind and Aaron Rodgers-type magic at the end of every game. And so while I think they're going to win at least one game in the playoffs, I think they do fall in the NFC Championship game.
Well, you know, the 49ers, as of right now, there's like 5 minutes left. I think they're up on the Seattle Seahawks 26-14. So it's looking like they're going to win, which will probably make them the one seed, make the Packers the two seed. How impressive has Matt LaFleur been in his first season as a head coach? Because I remember when we talked rookie head coaches way, way back in the day, and we said who we predicted would be the most successful. And I went with Matt LaFleur because I'm like, he's the only one with a good quarterback. And here he is making me look like a genius once again. How impressed have you been, especially as a Wisconsin native, of Matt LaFleur in season one, if you've been impressed at all?
I've been really impressed. And the reason that I thought he would be such a perfect fit was not only his offense, which I felt fit perfectly with Aaron Rodgers. I thought that his style and personality would mesh perfectly with Aaron Rodgers. Aaron needed a partner. He didn't need somebody to teach him how to be a professional. He didn't need somebody to teach him how to be a quarterback. He needed somebody to bring a different outlook on the game to him where they could work hand in hand like partners. Some quarterbacks need a boss. Some need a partner. Aaron Rodgers needed a partner, yep. And Matt LaFleur has been perfect for him.
All right, so let's move from there on to our next segment, world famous, Am I Tripping?
Guys, Derrick Henry racked up 211 rushing yards Sunday against Houston. He finished the season with a league-leading 1,540 rushing yards and 18 total touchdowns. Am I tripping, or is Derrick Henry the best running back in the NFL?
Who? I'm going to go first here, Joe. I'm going to say you're not tripping. He's definitely in the argument. I would say he's 1A or 1B, and we'll talk a little more in depth about the Nick Chubb situation, another guy who I think is up there for the top running backs. I don't really have a top guy. I have a top five. Here's my top five most talented running backs. If I was starting a team today, I would want one of these five backs as my running backs. Christian McCaffrey, Derrick Henry, Nick Chubb, Joe Mixon, or Josh Jacobs. Those are my top five most talented running backs in the NFL. But you are?
No Saquon, no Zeke, no Kamara.
I like Saquon. Saquon's in there. Okay, take Josh Jacobs out. Give me Saquon. I don't want to go with Zeke. I don't like how Zeke was getting tackled in the hole in one-on-one too many times this year. I like Kamara, but when I need to line you up and just give you the ball 25 times, I don't know. Kamara's my dog. I think he's one of the most well-rounded backs, but I have to see him carry the load a little bit more. I like my running backs to carry the load, as you can tell from the five that I selected. I'm a little more traditional.
That's the problem if you ever try to make a list off the top of your head and you don't write it down. You always forget a couple guys that are just slam dunks. So I'm not going to make a list.
Like when you did your top five quarterbacks under 25 and didn't put Mahomes in it.
Yeah, that was a mistake. That was a little bit of an overstate there. But you know what? I knew he was going to get injured in the middle of 2019 and Lamar Jackson was going to clearly play better. I knew it. I'm going to answer John's question. You are tripping because Nick Chubb is the best running back in the NFL. Derrick Henry is a lot like Nick Chubb, but Derrick Henry does not have the shiftiness and the ability to make drastic, quick cuts in short areas like Nick Chubb can. And so I think Nick Chubb's a better version of Derrick Henry.
Fair enough, guys. Here's a list of 10 quarterbacks who may be playing for new teams next season. Tom Brady, Phil Rivers, Jameis Winston, Eli Manning, Andy Dalton, Marcus Mariota, Ryan Fitzpatrick. I'll even throw Teddy Bridgewater and Mitchell Trubisky in there. My guess is at least half of these guys are not going to be on the same team in 2020. Am I tripping, or are we about to see a QB carousel like we've never seen before?
We will, because it's a changing of the guard in the NFL. If you look, man, there's just a lot of old-time quarterbacks that we've seen who were starters for a very long time that are no longer going to be starters, not just for their own teams. Like, they may not be starters ever again. I don't think Eli Manning is ever going to start for a football team again. I don't know if Phillip Rivers is going to start for a football team again. Ryan Fitzpatrick, no one's going to sign him to be a starter. Mitch Trubisky, I don't think he'll start. I don't think Marcus Mariota will start. Arguably, I think Andy Dalton will get a job. I think Teddy Bridgewater will be a starter. I just think a lot of the young guys, when you look at the top guys, where usually it's like at the 15 quarterback mark, it just tails off, right? And you're like, that 15 guy is a guy that you're like, oh, I could take him or leave him. I think when you look now, you can pretty easily pick out the top 20 quarterbacks and still feel really good about them. And then you have a whole new crop of like 5 to 6 to 7 guys who are going to come in and probably be day one starters next year. So you're going to have like literally an entire league of people that probably aren't looking for new quarterbacks barring injury.
I think there's going to be a big quarterback carousel, and it's not for the reason that you think. I was thinking about this today as I was driving back from the farm, and for a long time, quarterback salaries were very much underneath what their value was to the team. And so because of that inefficiency, because of that arbitrage between their value and their value as far as how much they're getting paid and their true value, which is what they're actually bringing to the team, teams were quickly locking up quarterbacks as fast as they could, and then those guys never saw free agency because their salaries weren't even close to fair market value. So you didn't see a lot of exchanging of quarterbacks from team to team. Well, now that the quarterback salaries have risen significantly, you're seeing teams that are actually having to make a decision on, is this guy worth $35 million? Like right now in Dallas, is Dak Prescott worth $35 to $40 million a year? Maybe, but maybe not. And so there's a legitimate opportunity and a chance that these guys don't come to an agreement. And now you could say they're probably going to get franchised, but there's more quarterbacks now than ever before that are going to go to free agency, like those names that you just mentioned, and that are going to sign probably like 2-year deals, 2 years, $60 million, 3 years with 2 years guaranteed for like $75 million. And so I think because of that, you're going to see a ton of movement now, and it's actually going to make the league much more competitive. And I'm looking forward to it because I would love to see Andy Dalton sign in Chicago and push Mitch Trubisky for the job. I thought Ryan Tannehill going to Tennessee was great because now they got an opportunity to replace Marcus Mariota in-house. They don't have to wait till the end of the season, and they're able to make the playoffs. Yep. Jameis Winston. Does he come back in Tampa? Probably. They're not going to sign him to a long-term deal, though, because a 7-year deal would mean they're going to have to pay him $200 million, and they're not ready to do that right now. And so I think you give him a 1 or 2-year deal, and it's another one of those prove-it type contracts. But we're going to see a lot of shifting, and I think it's going to be great for the NFL. And I think that's why the NFL is going to continue to be the greatest, most entertaining professional sports league in the world.
Last one, guys. According to my math, a total of 6 teams will be looking for new head coaches this offseason. The Redskins, Panthers, and Cleveland Browns have all fired their coaches. I have the Jaguars, Cowboys, and Giants. Am I tripping, or is there 6 teams that are going to need new head coaches next year?
Yeah, you're tripping because it's only going to be 5. I don't think the Cowboys are going to get rid of Jason Garrett.
Whoa, that's a hot take.
Yeah, I think they're going to give him another season in perpetuity. I think every year they're going to give him another season. He will be the Dallas Cowboys head coach until we all croak.
I think there's going to be more than 6. I'm taking the over because there's always a surprise head coaching firing that you didn't think about, that you didn't expect, that comes up because there's some weird personality issue or something that's going on behind the scenes that hasn't been reported on. And I think it's pretty safe that those 6 teams that you mentioned are all going to be looking for new head coaches, but there's going to be at least one surprise by the time we're talking next Sunday at this
Which
time.
One is it? Pick it. What's the surprise?
Well, I'm saying it's a surprise because it's a surprise. Well,
give us your prediction of what the surprise is going to be to the world. Nothing's a surprise to us on the Tomahawk Show because we know everything. That is standard. Everyone understands that. So for your prediction, Joe, which team is going to be the surprise firing?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Hawk, because my surprise coach firing in the NFL is going to be Lions coach Matt Patricia. Even though the Lions have come out already and said he's safe, I definitely think there's going to be one coaching situation that surprises us, and either Black Monday or it might even happen a little later in the week when the management has a chance to meet with the coaching staff. They meet with each other. They talk about the direction of the team. And then there's a name that may pop up that could be the potential coach that they don't want to miss out on that opportunity. So they quickly dump their coach and they pick somebody else up. And if I had to guess who that would be, it's going to be in Detroit.
I'm gonna go with a surprise firing. It's a bold prediction. We don't got to be right. That's why it's a surprise. I'm going to go with Bill O'Brien and the Houston Texans. If they lose the first round of the playoffs, they will be a surprise firing that no one sees
that's
coming.
That's a good one, Hawk.
Thank you. All right. Without further ado, you know what time it is. We know why you came. We know what you want to hear. We're talking about coaching changes and all things Cleveland Browns right now in Dog Check.
Dog Check!
All right. So the Browns took an L to the Cincinnati Bengals. In week 17, the Bengals, at the time, the 1-14 Bengals, the Bengals who are picking first overall.
The mighty
Cincinnati Bengals, who watched probably their future quarterback throw for 7 touchdowns and over 400 yards in the first half of a bowl game this week for LSU. but that doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the Cleveland Browns. I actually picked the Bengals to win in my pick 'em this week because I didn't like the vibe of the Browns. It didn't feel right, and we've seen this way too many times this year, Joe, or we're watching and not even not just seeing it this year. We know what that feeling looks like when a team is just not gelling. The team hasn't gelled all year, and the culmination happened in week 17 when they lost to the worst team in the NFL. What did you see in the loss to Cincinnati, Joe, that was popping out to you as I'm sure you were glued to the television?
So everybody was looking for that moment in the game, like, ah, there it is. They can't keep Freddie around because of this. And so I was one of those guys. Like, I'm curious, obviously, understanding that the outcome of this game is going to have probably some type of impact on the decision makers on whether Freddie comes back and all the other players that are out there. There's decisions that are being made right now. And that's what we always said, that even though week 17, most of my career was meaningless, actually, my entire career, week 17 was meaningless, because even the year we went 10-6, it didn't matter if we won or lost the last game, because it only mattered if Tennessee was going to beat the Colts in week 17. So, but anyways, we always said that week 17 matters because it becomes your resume for next year, because it's the last thing that decision maker is going to see from you before they decide, do we bring this person back or not for the next year? And a lot of times it can either build momentum or you can lose momentum moving into the offseason, depending on how the end of your season goes and all those cliches in football about you're only as good as your last game. And so week 17 is important for everybody, not just the coach. And when I was watching the game, I was concerned on a lot of levels, and it made me think that they're probably definitely going to fire Freddie Kitchens, because the effort just didn't seem great from the team. They just looked uninspired out there. I was watching guys pull up short on tackles, not selling out to try to get players to the ground that were ball carriers. I didn't see great effort by the receivers when Baker started scrambling. There was even one moment in the game, it was like a third down. It looked like there was some like comebacks and curl routes in the secondary, and the receivers, they ran their route and basically just stopped. And then Baker was like, crap. And he tried to run around and he ended up getting sacked. And the announcer in that game said something about like, well, not great effort from the Browns receivers there. They got to start the scramble drill or start working a little bit harder to try to get open for their quarterback on third and long. I didn't see great play calling in the game. I mean, I think we all kind of said, all right, what are we playing for down the stretch in this season here? Because the Browns are out of the playoffs. So what are we playing for? Okay, we want to become a team that can have a dominant front on both sides of the ball. We want to win the rushing title for Nick Chubb. He's been a great teammate, a great player. He deserves to win the rushing title. So if nothing else, we don't even care if we don't win the game. We're going to give the ball 20 to 30 times to Nick Chubb, and he's going to get his 150 or whatever he's going to need to win the rushing title in the NFL. And they didn't even do that. They gave him the ball like 12 times. And so the one thing that you may have been able to hang your hat on and motivate the team with is, hey, everybody loves Nick Chubb. He's been the consummate professional. He's been a great teammate. Let's get this guy something that matters. Let's walk out of this season, no matter what happens, saying, hey, we didn't live up to expectations, but we did something for our boy. We did something that we can be proud of. He won the NFL rushing title, and they weren't even able to do that. The play calling kind of looked disjointed. The team just looked disjointed because they'd have a great play, but then they would never be able to follow it up with any consistency. I think Baker completed 12 passes, even though he almost had 300 yards passing because he threw a couple deep balls. But then the rest of the game, they had a hard time completing any passes. You know, the defense was overmatched because Miles isn't in there. And they just overall, all across the board, uninspired. And then you lose by double digits to the worst team in the NFL that had one win going into that game. Just all around terrible. Everything was bad. Effort, results, the feeling, watching the game. It just, you walked out of there going, this was horrible and we need to make a change.
Yeah, no, I mean, we talked about it a little bit last episode where we talked about what does Freddie Kitchens have to do to keep his job. And I'm like, if they lose to the Bengals, there's nothing he can do. There's nothing he can do because of just the situation, like you said. And it's tough to motivate a team with nothing to play for in week 17. I understand that, because guys are really, I've been in those games where you're thinking, yes, I want to win, I want to play well, but probably more than either one of those, I don't want to get hurt. The worst thing you could possibly do is get hurt in a week 17. And I get people are like, well, why should you be focused on that? It's because it sucks. You know, like, you don't want to get hurt for no reason. I mean, nobody does. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't think it affects anybody's play. But collectively, if a lot of people are thinking that way, then yeah, that's the reason why you watched the game and it looked like the Bengals were playing for something. You know why? Because they realize it's probably Andy Dalton's last game playing there. It's probably Tyler Eifert's last game playing there. And you have these players on the team who have been there for so many years. They were there when they were successful, and they understand there's going to be a changing of the guard in a lot of respects. And, you know, we talked about him earlier, but Joe Mixon, man, I mean, that dude was running like...
Played hard.
Oh, my gosh, man. I mean, he was running through Cleveland's defense. And when I'm not saying that figuratively, there was multiple times where he would break three and four tackles in a play, or he would just literally run right through a defender and keep running like they weren't even there. You know, and that's why I said he's a top five talented back in his league.
Real quick, sorry. It's interesting your perspective in week 17 was like, don't get hurt.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we called it the don't get hurt bowl, but most of the teams that I played on, actually the mantra was, even though we said it was the don't get hurt bowl, it was sort of the opposite mantra. It was like, well, why not go as hard as you want? Because even if you have the most catastrophic injury, all right, one like class two catastrophic, like torn ACL, torn rotator cuff, torn pec, like blowout Achilles, you still have the whole off season to get healthy before September to go back and play more football. And so we always thought, why not sell out? We got 6 months to rest up and feel good. And so actually, for the most part, throughout my career, week 17, even though we had nothing on the line, we played pretty hard. Like, for the most part, our teams did a pretty good job, and we won not a lot of the games, but probably more than teams would expect, because I think we just had that mentality, like, screw it, it doesn't matter. Season's already over. We've got a long time off, so might as well go sell out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe for you, man, who lived in Cleveland already, so it wouldn't have mattered. That wouldn't have altered your offseason plans. Like, because if I get hurt, if I tear my ACL, I have to be in Cleveland the entire offseason. If you don't,
that's exactly why it's the don't get hurt bowl.
That's why.
Because everybody's got plans. They want to get out of town. They want to go on vacation. They want to go move to their other house. And they don't want to be in Cleveland January, February, March, rehabbing an injury.
Right. And then on top of that, for Joe Thomas, it doesn't matter if Joe Thomas tears his ACL, because they'll give Joe Thomas 2 years to get his ACL right. For Andrew Hawkins, if I tear my ACL, even after a decent season, it gives him an out to cut me. Like, oh, okay, good. We can get rid of that guy.
Yes.
As soon as he heals, send his ass out of here. Like, that's the end of the Andrew Hawkins era, whatever city I'm playing in. So that was my other thinking of the don't get hurt in the Week 17 Bowl. All right, so they fired Freddie Kitchens, Joe. Nothing to be, I know a lot of fans were like, yeah, we want to make a change. You know, everyone's take on it is different. Like, what do you feel when you see that Freddie Kitchens gets let go after one season in Cleveland? Something we've seen multiple times, and we on this show and between us have talked about, even as teammates in the NFL, saying that a one and done doesn't really always make sense.
Yeah, I don't like the one and done, because I lived it and I just felt like it was unfair, because as a head coach, it takes multiple years to be able to change culture, to sort of set the foundation that you want to build on. And so you're not always going to see the results in year one, especially when you think back at like some of the great coaching staffs in NFL history. You think back to like Belichick and Parcells and Jimmy Johnson in Dallas. Those guys, a lot of those guys, they started out really poorly. Why? Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to change a culture by instilling discipline. They're instilling accountability. And you get a lot of pushback initially when you're trying to do that with players. And so a lot of times, especially the beginning part of the season, can be really rough, because those players, it's like dealing with a kid who's not wanting to make that change. They actually do the opposite. Like, instead of taking the coaching, they're trying to prove that you're wrong. And it's a little bit of a power struggle, but a lot of times between the players and the coaches. But by a lot of times the midpoint towards the end of the season, you start seeing players falling in line, and the guys that aren't falling in line start getting cut or start going somewhere else. They fall by the wayside. And so you finally get that group of players that you want to be there to kind of build your program around. And a lot of times you don't have the talent to be able to do it right away. I mean, there's a reason the coach got fired the year before, for the most part, is because you didn't have a lot of talent. And so it takes time to accumulate that talent and then coach them up into your system and then start coaching the details and then start seeing them on the field. Like, this is not something that can be built in one day. With that all being said, I think the Browns were able to see enough from Freddie and his staff in 1 year to say that this is not a developmental league. He does not currently have the skill set to be a head coach in the NFL. And it's too important with the way the roster is set up right now, with Baker on a rookie contract, with all these other star young players that are about to come up for free agency in 2 or 3 years that are going to have to get paid, that the time for the Browns to win is right now. Like, they are in that 2 to 3 year window where they need to make hay, because those guys are going to get paid and a lot of them are going to have to leave and they're going to need to be replaced with younger players. And so this is not a learn on the job head coaching position. And because of the lack of discipline, the lack of accountability that showed up with penalties and outbursts on the field and pre-snap penalties, unnecessary roughness penalties, the different things that the players were saying in the media throughout the season that become distractions, the way Baker threw the training staff under the bus, the way that towards the end of the season, you heard the players not really even lobbying or defending for Freddie when they were getting asked about him in the media. I think the media was asking Baker, who out of anybody is the one reason that Freddie got the job, is because of his relationship with Baker.
Yeah.
And Baker even said, like, oh, whatever happens, happens.
Now, is that indicative of Baker, or is that indicative of what Freddie is? That's my question. Because
people argue
the reason why it's not a good idea to fire Freddie is because now you have a quarterback who you say is the future of your franchise and has showed promise, obviously, in his rookie season. And now he is working on his third head coach, third offensive coordinator in 3 years. That'll be their argument.
You want to get it right, because what you saw is when Freddie took over, Baker got worse. And I think it's just because it's Baker's mentality. Baker performs the best when he's got the chip on his shoulder. He feels like everybody's against him. He feels like he's got no allies. And that's why I think last year he played so well. Why? Because he hated Hugh, which we saw with how he acted when they went and played in Cincinnati.
Right.
He hated Greg Williams, who was the head coach, and he couldn't wait to see Greg Williams get fired. But it was that, like, push and pull that I feel like got the best out of Baker. And because Freddie was there in the quarterback room and then became the offensive coordinator, he felt like, hey, you're my only ally. You're the guy I need to work with. And there was a bond that was built that got the most out of Baker, but it wasn't because of his bond with Freddie. It was because how much he despised Hugh and Greg for the like their approach, which was no nonsense. It was tough. It was, we're going to be hard on you. Right. We're going to not make it easy on anybody. And that's what caused Baker to develop and have, in my opinion, a great season that he had. Whereas you get all those guys out of the building that were maybe hard on Baker. And then now one guy who is maybe your biggest ally, who is your best buddy, is now in the head coaching position. You kind of feel like, oh, I can just kind of relax a little bit right now. Yep. I got everything I want. I can go be me, and I got everything figured out. When we all know that when we were 23, 24 years old in the NFL, we thought we all had it figured out, but we had a lot to learn still. And it was helpful to have somebody in there, just like I talked about at the beginning of the show with Mangini. Like, now that I look back on my time with Eric Mangini, I realize that he made me a much smarter football player, a much tougher person in general, because he put us through hell. And when you're 24, 25 years old, you don't always have that perspective. But now that I'm 35, I can look back on that and say that was a valuable part of my growth and development as a football player. I'd already made Pro Bowls before Mangini came there, but he took me to the next level because I hated him so much. He put me through so much misery. He made it so hard on me that every day I demanded so much out of myself because I feared the public humiliation I was going to get from the coaching staff over every little thing that I did. And so I made sure every I was dotted and every T was crossed. And I just don't feel like Freddie built that environment. And especially you saw it with Baker, who is the most valuable part of that franchise, the most valuable piece of this puzzle. And that's why they felt you got to get rid of Freddie, because we need to bring in somebody there that's going to be really hard on Baker and it's going to get the most out of him.
I mean, how do you keep a guy whose biggest ally says, yeah, what happens, happens? Right. Like, it's like the guy who got you the job, the guy that, you know, you felt best about or felt best about you. What happens, happens. And so that would be my argument to the people that say now we're moving on to three head coaches, three offensive coordinators in 3 years. You know, well, Hugh was gone large in part because Baker didn't rock with him. Right. Got him out of there. Greg
and
Williams.
To be fair, there was a lot of losing.
It was, I mean, 31-31 might have helped as well. But what I'm saying is Baker didn't want to stay with Hugh, right? So they had to make that change. He didn't want to stay with Greg. So although it wasn't an official coaching change, that's why Greg Williams wasn't an option. And now Freddie, if he says whatever happens, happens to this guy, well, guess what? He's going to be gone too. It's funny you talked about like the pushback, because I do think Baker needs that. Not just Baker. I think a lot of players need it. You know, when I was a player, I don't want to say I was never scared of an adversarial coach. Right? I don't care about hard work. That doesn't scare me at all. Like, there's nothing you could ever throw at me where I was going to say it was too much and to dial it back. And I didn't mind doing it. I was all for the work if it made sense. You know, there's an old Paul Brown quote where he says, winning makes believers of us all, right? If you're just being a mean, like hard ass to be a hard ass, and it doesn't actually yield results, that doesn't make you a good coach. Like that, those are the guys I didn't like, right? Like if you come in and you actually know what you're doing and you understand how to build an organization, how to build a culture, and not just giving me a bunch of rah-rah regurgitated, this is what I'm supposed to do, you guys didn't do this, this is what, that's not going to work. And those guys, it always weeds itself out. You can't take the easy road out with any of this, though. You need a coach that understands how to build an organization, a winning organization, a coach who has the experience, that has done it time in and time out, the guy who knows how to handle talent, right? Because that was Freddie's biggest indictment. We said that when he got hired. We said he was in a catch-22 because we said if they won, they would say it was because of his talent. And if he lost, if they lost, they would say they're not doing well because it's Freddie's fault. And that came to fruition. That was what we said day one when they hired him. That
it was almost like the Mike Tomlin. It's almost like the Mike Tomlin situation when he takes over in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah.
They were loaded on offense and defense. They had a Hall of Fame quarterback. They had a Hall of Fame defensive coordinator. So basically, Mike Tomlin's just coming in and sitting in the seat and going, all right, this is pretty cool. Just size me up for my ring and then tell me when to show up for the ceremony.
Yep.
And so he never got any credit as a head coach. And granted, we don't even know if he was a good head coach early on, but he was able to grow into that position. And now losing Big Ben, losing all those weapons on offense,
yep,
and seeing what type of a disaster Antonio Brown has been once he leaves there, you realize, wow, Mike Tomlin's been doing a very good job.
He must be
decent. We didn't know it. He must be a really good head coach because he got that team full of a good defense, but not a lot of talent on offense to 8-8.
Yeah.
And they had a pretty successful season. He was able to hold all those divas together and perform very, very well and win Super Bowls. And so he gets a lot of credit. Whereas I think Freddie was kind of in a similar situation when he took over. Like you mentioned, if you don't do well, it's your fault. If you do well, it's somebody else's credit.
Yep. It's John Dorsey for building the roster. It's the roster is so talented. You know, and to be very clear, man, I never celebrate when a coach gets fired. It sucks. Right. But I also don't cry a lot of tears. I'm going to be honest with you, because a lot of times, especially working in NFL media and, you know, covering sports for some of the big places, and you always see where it's like, yeah, they have a family. And yes, they do. That is very true. I'm not saying that's not a real thing. It is sad to lose your job. You know, Ian Rappaport reported that he talked to Freddie Kitchens, and Freddie Kitchens was emotional because he thought he had the support of the organization. The difference is, as a player, you know you never have the support of the organization, right? You know when you get cut, you also have a family. So, again, I never celebrate when someone loses their job. That's not what this is. This is very cut and dry. It's football. It's a results-driven business. As a player, players get cut all the time that actually – did give results, right? And they pick up and they move across the country with their four or five kids, or they void the back end of their contracts, and you know, and it's just business as usual. So that's just how I approach coaching as well. Like, I don't like when a coach gets fired when I don't think he deserves it, and I don't like, you know, if a coach gets fired and I think he did, then, you know, this is the price of doing business. This is just the business of football to me.
Here's what I'm going to say about that. And When Freddie was talking to supposedly Ian Rappaport, which we may or may not know if that happened, but Ian reported that he talked to him and Freddie was very emotional about it, thinking that he had the support of the administration or the front office. Mm-hmm. And this just completely encapsulates everything that Freddie Kitchens was as a head coach. And he did not even know what he didn't know as a head coach. His lack of experience in that role, his lack of experience in the coordinator role, which is much closer to the CEO type role that you are as a head coach than when you were a quarterbacks or a running backs coach, which is kind of the guy that's basically the closest to the players, because you spend a lot of time with your players in the meeting room. And then other than that, you're just kind of like the low man on the totem pole who shits on the head coach and the stuff that the coordinator is doing and the front office. Like, you're just like a player. You go and bitch about everybody that's above you just the same way. Just and like you have no concept, and you've not even been thinking about, oh, when I'm the head coach, I'm going to do this differently, or I'm going to take things from this head coach that I've worked for, or that head coach, or you don't have any of those experiences that, because you haven't even been thinking about being a head coach. And so for Freddie to think that because the front office a couple weeks ago or this week maybe showed him a public showing of like, yeah, we'll probably bring you back, and to believe it, that just shows that you're inexperienced, because as you know, you and I have been through a lot of these situations. Typically the organization is going to show you support right up until the second that they fire you, because they want to make sure that you have everything in your power to succeed, and that you never can say, well, they didn't give me a fair chance because they were saying that I was swinging in the wind 3 weeks before they actually fired me. And so I lost the respect and the power that I had in the position to be able to control and lead this team, because you guys kind of cut my nuts off by saying, well, we don't know if we're going to bring you back. And so of course they're going to show you support. So you shouldn't be surprised. Like any other coach that's been around this business for a while would be like, yeah, I kind of knew that was coming. Like I saw the writing on the wall. Maybe they told me that I was still going to be there, but I knew that I shouldn't believe everything that they're telling me, because that's just what they do when the head coach is in this situation.
That's it. I mean, here's a fact of life for everybody listening. This is football. This is life in general. This is anywhere. It is 2019. It's about to be 2020 in mere hours. Okay. When you're an adult and you have a job, you are doing one of two things. You're either actively getting a new job, or you are losing the one you have. There is no in between. So, and I say that in the coaching perspective, that you are either building your resume where other teams can't wait to have you, or you are on the way out the door in the one you have. So if you can look at what you're doing as a head coach and you say, man, I can't imagine another team would want me right now. Well, then guess what you are doing? You're in the process of losing your job. There is no in-between. There isn't just, oh, I just need to figure this out right now. You're either gaining credibility or you're losing it. And you're right. Like, Freddie Kitchens had no idea. And his awareness was a problem at multiple times in the season. Where it turned the tide for me, personally, where I was like, okay, this guy don't get it, is when he wore the Pittsburgh Started It t-shirt. I thought that was the dumbest thing ever. It didn't make sense to me. I don't know why he would do it. And even worse, when he doubled down on it like two or three times, like, it wasn't even when he wore the shirt. Bad decision to wear the shirt. We make bad decisions. We all do. I get it. I understand. He had multiple opportunity to say that was a bad decision. And the last thing he said on it, which was the third time he was asked about it in a press conference setting, he said, if I could do it all over again, I would. Boom. That very moment, I said, okay, my man doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't get
it. It reminds me of, remember right before you had your first baby, you were thinking like, oh, this is going to be easy, right? Okay. We bring the baby home. The baby's going to sleep. Mommy's going to go up and feed it. Then mommy's going to put it down for like 2 or 3 hours. We'll get a good night's sleep. Mommy will wake up, feed it for a half hour, put it down during the day. It's going to be happy. We're going to feed it. We're going to change a diaper. We're going to go on life like it's normal. Everyday life hasn't changed one bit, right? Then as soon as you bring the baby home, it's like, holy crap. I didn't even realize how hard this was going to be.
Yeah.
I was told how hard this was going to be. But until you experience it, you have no concept, because you don't even know what you don't know.
You don't know.
And until you're there, you can't even imagine how much this is going to change your life. And that's exactly like with Freddie. He didn't even know wearing the t-shirt was going to be a bad look. And then he didn't even realize
the baby was going to sleep all during the day and think that was nighttime.
Yeah, and then be up all night. Cry and be up all night.
He didn't know a little human could shit up its back, like all the way to its hairline. And there's just a line of fecal matter from his hairline.
It's the mohawk.
To the bottom of his taint. Like, it's just, he didn't know. He didn't know that the baby was going to projectile piss as soon as you open the diaper over everything.
And if you don't know that the baby is going to projectile piss as soon as that little Peter gets into the cold air, then how are you going to be able to tell your players that you shouldn't do this because this is going to happen?
Right.
Because you don't even know.
You don't know. And you're all getting pissed at the same time, because we're all looking. Job, we don't know what's going to happen.
Yes. Your job is to be a great leader and to be able to see the icebergs that are coming up ahead of the Titanic and be able to say, hey, Baker, maybe you shouldn't throw the medical staff under the bus because that's going to make everybody look bad. So whatever you do, don't talk about another player's injuries. And certainly don't be throwing our own staff under the bus. Handle those things in-house. Let's not go off on reporters in the middle of the season. That's just a bad look for us. Let's make sure we're keeping this all about us. Let's keep the focus on us. Let's not focus on other things. Like, if you can't be that guiding hand, that person that installs, instills wisdom in your team on a daily basis and says, I've been there before. I know how this ends. So don't do this. This is why. Like, how can you expect them to be the leader that takes you where you want to go?
Yeah, that's profound stuff, man. Yeah. Profound. It's why the Belichick say, do your job. Don't do everyone else's job. Simple as that. Like, let's do our job. What is our job, Freddie? To make sure everyone does their job. That should be the only thing we talk about.
Pretty
right?
Simple.
Like, it's not your job to comment on so-and-so's contract. Let it ride. Not our job there.
Here's a quick story. My second year in the NFL, we fired Romeo Crennel, and he'd already won like six Super Bowls because he coached with Parcells and Belichick. And so he had a million Super Bowls. He just got an extension the year before. And so he still had like 3 years. He was going to be getting paid at, you know, $3 or $4 million a year to go get what we call mailbox money, which it shows up twice a month. You just go to the mailbox, collect your check. It's not too bad. So I think Freddie, after he gets over the shock and the awe and the disappointment of the season and of being fired, by the time he wakes up next week, he's going to be like, holy crap. If I don't want to do anything for 3 years, I'm still getting paid $3 or $4 million a year.
Oh, yeah.
And all I got to do is make sure that my address is current.
Yep, that's it. You got to update your address with the Cleveland Browns.
So after we fired Romeo, we were all in there and he addressed the team. And like, there was guys that were upset, especially guys that had been with him a long time. And me being a young player, I'd never been through a losing season. That was my first losing season of my life. Cause first year in the NFL, we were 10-6. Second year, we were 4-12. And so I was a little shook up, and then they fired the coach and they fired the GM. And I was like shook up, but I'll never forget. Romeo stood up in front of us and he goes, "Don't feel sorry for me, guys." And he started laughing. He goes, "I got 3 years left of my contract and they got to pay me every single cent." So for those of you that have a heart like me, unlike Hawk, who's a savage beast, who have a heart and feel bad for Freddie and his family, don't feel that bad, because he's still going to get paid a lot of money and he'll find his way into the NFL probably next year or the year after. And that's the way it works in the coaching world. That's what you accept when you take the job as a head coach. Yeah. You realize that, hey, it's a win-loss business. I get measured by results, not by perception, not by how we think we were doing. But hey, you know what? I'm willing to get fired or get hired every 2 years. We're going to move around the country. That's just the life that I've chosen.
This is the life. All right. So now we're looking forward, right? We're looking at head coaching candidates. The Browns are on the market. They're on the clock once again to choose a head coach. Joe, let's just talk some names, man. There's a lot of names out there. We've had our eyes out there scouting. So give me some names that you're thinking and tell me why or why they wouldn't be a good fit.
So the first guy I'm going to say that I think would be a good fit is Mike McCarthy. He's the name that's been very popularly associated with this job. He was a guy that worked with John Dorsey in Green Bay. He's a guy that's a proven winner. He won a Super Bowl in Green Bay. He's an offensive mind. He worked with Aaron Rodgers very well for a lot of years until the end. They kind of had a little bit of a falling out. He's a guy that's going to be a little stern and gruff. And I think, that's probably who they're going to be looking for, but more than anything, somebody I think with some experience so that they don't have to go through all the growing and learning pains that they did with Freddie, because like we mentioned, they're in a win now mode because of how the roster is put together. The next name I'm going to bring up is Kevin Stefanski, offensive coordinator for the Minnesota Vikings. Yeah. He's a guy that almost got the job, I think last year. He runs the Kyle Shanahan scheme, because he runs the scheme, which I think is the best current offensive scheme in the NFL for a generic quarterback. You know, outside of if you have Lamar Jackson, obviously you run the Lamar Jackson run first quarterback school of zone read and RPOs. But if you just have any other random white quarterback in the NFL, you run the Kyle Shanahan, Jimmy Garoppolo wide zone play action scheme, right?
Okay.
And so I think Baker fits pretty well in that scheme because he's a mobile quarterback. He moves pretty well.
Yeah.
And then it still also incorporates some of those easy zone read RPO type things that we tried to do with Johnny when they put Johnny in there. And right now I think it's pretty well known that Baker is very comfortable with the style of play that he did when he was in college, where it's the zone read, the RPO. It's like okay. The pretty easy. Okay. Read the safety on this play. Okay. Read the middle linebacker. Okay. Read this one. If it's a split safety look, you're going to read this one inside out. Like, pretty simple stuff, but you can build into some more of that graduate level, like deeper thinking offensive stuff with Stefanski. But here's a name that I don't know if anybody mentioned, but to me, I actually think would be the perfect choice for where the Browns are and what they need from a head coaching standpoint.
Can I take
a
guess?
I'm going to go ahead and toot my own horn here for just 1 second.
All right, go ahead.
There's a little guy named Matt LaFleur, who's the head coach of the Green Bay Packers right now.
We can't get him, Joe. He's doing pretty well.
We can't get him.
I appreciate that suggestion, but he's under contract.
I was the first one a full 14 months ago. I think it was right after they fired Mike McCarthy, which was like October, November last year in Green Bay.
Yep.
They fired him, from what I remember, early on in the season. And like the day he got fired, I go, the guy that they need to hire is Matt LaFleur, who was the current offensive coordinator at the time of the Tennessee Titans. Nobody in the country knew who Matt LaFleur was.
You heard it here first. Nobody said it.
Everybody was talking about all these other names. I said, no. Matt LaFleur, first of all, he would be a fantastic choice because he runs a system that would be perfect for Aaron Rodgers. But I think more than that, when you're hiring a head coach, you need to look personality-wise. And how are they going to fit with the core group of players that you have on your team? And are they going to be the type of person that they need, right? Like, I'm a tall guy. I was looking for a tall woman to marry.
Too. I get it.
Right? Yep. Hawk, you were a tall guy, and you were looking for a medium height woman when you were looking to get married, right?
I like the tower over my woman.
The shoe, maybe I'm a 15. Hawk, you're not a 15. You're maybe a 14 and a half.
Yeah.
Extra wide, but still 14 and a half. And so 14, my point is not everybody wears the same size shoe. So you got to figure out how big your feet are of the core players on your team and what's the shoe that's going to fit them. It's not a one size fits all. There's a reason that coaches like Belichick.
You can't just go Air Monarch and everything.
But there's a reason that coaches don't work at every situation they go to. And yeah, some of it is they didn't have the talent there and they had the talent here, but a lot of it's fit. And for the Browns right now, they have a young group of talented players who have a lot of personality.
Okay, and this is quite the setup for this suggestion. This is the setup. I cannot wait to hear this.
To me, the coach that they need is an offensive-minded coach who can develop Baker.
Uh-oh, he's going to say a player
who's going to respect Baker Mayfield. But he's not going to love as his buddy. He's not going to be the guy that just sits there.
You're suggesting Baker himself coach the team.
Sits there and just kisses his butt. He's going to push him. And at the beginning, you're probably going to hear Baker say a lot of things that he doesn't like about this guy. He's not going to be very glowing in his report because he's going to be really pushing him. He's going to be hard on him. And a lot of times there's going to be a lot of pushback, especially with Baker's personality, which is sort of, I know everything and I don't need anybody else's help. This week, Baker was asked about if he's going to use any quarterback guru or coach or trainers in the offseason, like Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Aaron Rodgers. Basically, every quarterback in the NFL uses this guy, Tom House, and his academy out on the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
And originally, it was unconventional stuff that he was using for NFL quarterbacks because he's bringing a lot of baseball stuff into it. Uh-huh. But as all these great quarterbacks started realizing how beneficial it was, everybody started using it and now it became commonly accepted. But Baker has already said multiple times that he's not interested in that. He doesn't need a quarterback guru to put him in the ocean and have him throw footballs underwater or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what the reference was, but he's made it very clear that he doesn't need anybody to teach him how to run a three-step drop. And he doesn't need anybody to help him work on his footwork because he can watch the film himself and make the corrections that are necessary. The guy that I'm going to mention is a guy that's going to be hard on him and he probably wouldn't like at the beginning, but he's young. He's a very, very smart offensive mind, but he's very tough and discipline is important. Accountability is important. He's worked for Nick Saban. He's worked for Bill Belichick multiple times on both sides of the ball. He's been an offensive coordinator at multiple teams in the NFL. And he's also worked for multiple different head coaches, which I think when you're hiring a head coach, he doesn't always have to have head coaching experience, but I think the fact that he's worked for multiple head coaches is really important because when you're a young coach or an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, and you aspire to be a head coach, you're always thinking when you're working for other head coaches are, what are the things that he does that I like that I want to take from him? What are the things that he does that I don't really like and I want to make sure I avoid as a head coach? And so you're kind of meandering your way through this maze of, okay, this is what I want to do and what I want to be when I become a head coach. And so the Buffalo Bills offensive coordinator is a guy named Brian Daboll, who was the offensive coordinator for the Cleveland Browns in 2009 and 2010. We didn't have a lot of success. You probably don't know his name, but he's done a good job working with Josh Allen. He's coached under Sean McDermott. Like I mentioned, he's coached for Nick Saban. He's coached for Bill Belichick multiple times. He's got a very, very vast football knowledge. He's a very bright coach, but he's very tough. And I think he would just be absolutely the perfect coach for who the Cleveland Browns are right now. He'd be able to manage all those personalities. Okay. He'd be able to get the most out of Baker. He'd be able to turn Baker into a Pro Bowl level quarterback who acts like the face of the franchise that I think we all want to see Baker act in a mature and professional manner. And I think this is the guy for the job.
Brian Daboll. I like that. I like that one. McCarthy will be a tough one for me. I want McCarthy. I like McCarthy. I want a lot of people. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't have a dog in the fight.
So you just said McCarthy would be a tough one for me, but here's why. Like McCarthy let me and I want him.
Let me okay, all right, sorry. Joseph you're Hayden. The professional.
All right. So I like McCarthy. I want to preface it with saying that. I don't know if McCarthy and Dorsey would work, even though they've worked together before, right? But now they're in a situation where there has to be a big dog, which I think played into the reason why Dorsey wanted Freddie, because he was clearly the big dog in that equation, right? I mean, we know John Dorsey has a strong personality. We know Mike McCarthy also has a strong personality. So it comes down to who will be the big dog. And one thing Jimmy Haslam does not like, it is when you're off or when your general manager and your head coach are not on the same page. Because what happens is when things don't go right, there's finger pointing, right? And it's got to be your fault. Otherwise, it's going to be my ass. I don't know. I'm not saying that's going to be the case, but I know McCarthy is not going to go into a situation where he does not have control of the roster, because he'll have the ability for, I think he'll have enough opportunities in the NFL where they will give him that because he's earned that. He's a Super Bowl winning head coach. He's going to go in and say, I want the roster, because there's other coaches who get the roster who don't have nearly the resume or success that he's had. That's my thing on McCarthy. Next up was Stefanski.
So I said Kevin Stefanski was the other one.
I like Stefanski.
I don't really know him personally. I don't know a lot of guys that have worked with him. But I think he's done a good job in Minnesota, and I think he has the right offensive background for Baker's skill sets and this team's skill set.
I mean, you know, look, I think Baker is very talented. I think Baker has a lot of development still to go, regardless of what Baker thinks. And some of that is just going to come with experience, but a lot of that is going to be a coach who understands what Baker's skill set is and puts him in the position to maximize his value, right? Similar to what Stefanski did for Kirk Cousins this year. There was a time where Kirk Cousins was a legitimate MVP candidate and in that conversation. And there was also a time before Stefanski got his offense going that Kirk Cousins, they say, went and robbed Minnesota blind of $84 million guaranteed. All right, so I'm going to throw a couple more names at you. Okay. Throw some more names at you. All right, Robert Saleh, defensive coordinator, 49ers. Give me the quick 3-minute version of yes or no.
Yeah, yeah. I'll keep it to 45 seconds. So don't know a lot about him. I know that he's kind of like a high energy, Pete Carroll-y type motivator. Mm-hmm. And I think that can work in the CEO type role as a head coach, because then you hire an offensive coordinator, you hire a defensive coordinator, you kind of let them do their thing. Uh-huh. I'm not against that, but if I want to see a guy who's more of the CEO type role, I would like to see a guy who's been around a lot longer.
Okay.
So I think about like, John Harbaugh, he's a classic like CEO head coach in Baltimore. And he'd been around a long time in the NFL as a special teams coach and kind of all over the place before he got that job. So he had a lot of experience to fall back on, and being in that CEO role is really good if you can delegate and you know a lot of people in the NFL and you've been around a long time. Robert Saleh hasn't, to my knowledge, been around all that long and hasn't had a ton of different experience. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot more unknown, in my opinion, if you're going to hire him to be that CEO type.
So you want an established guy.
If he's going to be CEO, if he's going to be like the offensive guru. So like they hired Kyle Shanahan to go to San Francisco. He had never been a head coach. He had been around, but they knew he was going to run the offense. And so they were okay with maybe having him delegate some of those CEO roles to maybe somebody else on the staff, because he was going to be more focused on, I'm running the offense, I'm developing the quarterback.
Do you have any qualms about a defensive minded head coach? Because Robert Slott's the coordinator. Do you think we're better off with an offensive head coach?
No. I don't have any qualms with a defensive-minded head coach. But the other reason I want a guy that's maybe more of an old head, if he's a defensive-minded head coach who goes to CEO, is because the number one most important thing that a head coach does is hire his assistant coaches. Because those are the guys that are going to be working with the players on a daily basis. They're going to be the ones that largely coming up with the offense and defensive game plan. And so if you've been around a long time, you've seen a lot of guys and you've worked with a lot of guys that you can pull from on a roster to make up your staff. If you're a young head coach, and we saw this with Mike Pettine a little bit, he hadn't had a lot of experience in the NFL. He'd worked mostly for Rex Ryan. And so when he hired his staff, he got really lucky with Kyle Shanahan.
Yep.
But like outside of that, he didn't have a lot of guys that he really knew to put his staff together. And so it's not that you can't hire a good staff, but there's a lot more unknowns that you have when you're putting that staff together, because you don't know the guys. You're interviewing them. You're taking other people's word that they're good at what they do and they work well with the players, but you don't have that firsthand experience that you can say, yeah, I know this guy because I've worked with him and he's great.
And Mike Pettine is a great defensive coordinator, and I thought he was a good head coach, especially I think he hit right with Kyle Shanahan. I think we can all agree on that But a lot of the other coaches in that staff, I think, is what did him in. And that's a good segue to the next name I'm going to give you, Greg Roman, who was the offensive coordinator for the Baltimore Ravens and obviously has turned Lamar Jackson from quote-unquote wide receiver running back project to NFL MVP at quarterback. And Greg Roman was a guy who was begging to come to the Cleveland Browns in 2015, and Mike Pettine interviewed. Mike Pettine ended up hiring John DeFilippo instead, and Greg Roman walked. So now Greg Roman will be a hot name on the head coaching circuit for what he's done in the time since then. What are your thoughts about him? Anything? Give me 30 seconds on Greg Roman, whether you give a shit or not.
Yeah, 30 seconds on Greg Roman is he may be a great head coach. He may not, but his coaching experience in the NFL is a little bit more limited. And what we know about Greg Roman is he worked really well with Colin Kaepernick and he did a great job with Lamar Jackson. And so why he is being promoted to being potentially a head coach is because of his offensive X's and O's mind with a quarterback that is more of a run first dual threat type quarterback, which those things don't always translate great to being a head coach, because what you have to have from a characteristic standpoint to be a great head coach is you need to be a great leader. You need to have discipline and accountability. You need to be a CEO, and you need to be able to delegate, and you need to be able to deal with the management, GM and owner, and you need to be the face of the franchise that communicates with your fan base. So these are all roles that have nothing to do with how good you are X's and O's wise. And so we know Greg Roman is great X's and O's when it comes to dealing with the dual threat running quarterback. But outside of that, we don't really know anything about him because he hasn't had to be the face of the franchise. He hasn't had to be in charge of a whole coaching staff. He hasn't had to have been the face of the franchise. He hasn't had to deal with the owner, and the GM, and the fan base, and the media. And you haven't had to do all those things that make a great head coach. And so there's another thing. There's a lot of unknowns with him. So I'd rather pick somebody with fewer unknowns, since this is such an important hire. Cause we talked about, this is a 2 to 4 year window the Browns have to win a Super Bowl.
All right. Next one, Josh McDaniels. Let me start off with Josh McDaniels real quick.
Go ahead.
You've been running for a while. Josh McDaniels, I think, is a great coach. I think he is a great offensive mind. A lot of things you're talking about. I think he has obviously head coaching experience, so he's been in that situation. But the one thing that rubs me the wrong way about Josh McDaniels, who was my offensive coordinator for about 28 days, was the Colts. Now, I don't have any backstory on the Indianapolis Colts situation where he accepted the job and then a couple days later decided he didn't want the job and they had to go back and they landed with Frank Reich, which I think was a great decision and hire for them, and it worked out. Yeah. But without understanding the backstory of that, I don't want the Browns to overextend themselves thinking that they're going to be the one to pry him away from New England Patriots. And also, I don't know if that's the kind of guy that you want in. And again, that's with me out without knowing any of the backstory of why he backed out of that situation. It's still just, this is how it works. I think his agent ended up firing, like leaving him, quitting after that, because it was such a black eye on his resume. Like, yeah, this is not how business works, right? So that's my only reservation with Josh McDaniels. What are your thoughts?
Well, character is obviously a big question mark with Josh because of what you mentioned, because when you accept the job as a head coach, now you hire a staff and now you're asking all those guys to leave the jobs that they have to pick their families up and move to you because they trust you and what you're trying to build there. So they go there and then now you say, oh, I had a change of heart. You can't do that. You have to be a man of your word. You have to go and take that job once you say you're going to do it, and you have to follow through. And so when you don't have those things, that's a huge question mark for me. Not that he's going to leave the Browns at the altar again, but if he's willing to do that to all these people that are going to be loyal assistants and loyal lieutenants to him, what does that say about the other decisions that he's going to have to make? Is he willing to throw people under the bus in other circumstances and situations? Is he going to be great at leading a group of coaches, which I said was the number one thing that a head coach has to do?
Yeah.
You have to manage and delegate your coaching staff, and you have to hire them, of course, and players. Like, to be able to do that to two layers of people takes an enormous amount of accountability, an enormous amount of leadership and commitment to principles. And there's a big question mark because of what he did in Indianapolis. But even more so than that, my big concern with Josh McDaniels is not that he's not a smart guy. He seems like he's a very bright offensive mind. He's been with Belichick forever, but that's the problem. His only experience coaching outside of, okay, he started as a grad assistant at Michigan State in 99 for a year. And then he's been with the Patriots the entire time, except for his stint for 2 years in Denver as the head coach, which started out pretty good. But then everybody turned on him because he was just trying to be the reincarnation of Belichick. And then he had like a hot second as an offensive coordinator in St. Louis. And then he's been back in New England. And so he doesn't have these experiences to pull off of outside of working for Belichick. And every Belichick disciple that we've seen, for the most part, has not had success because they just try to be Belichick rather than being your own person and pulling experiences from working with Belichick and working with Saban and working for Andy Reid and working for all these other coaches and then becoming your own version of the best version of yourself with the experience of working for those guys. You just try to be a clone of the only person that you've ever seen work for it. And that doesn't work. You have to be your own person. And so my biggest concern with Josh McDaniels is that he's hardly ever in his entire career, except for basically 3 years in the NFL or two and a half, maybe not even 2 years in the NFL, hasn't worked for anybody else. Because when he was the head coach, he wasn't working for anybody else. He was working for himself.
He was actually my OC in two places. So I was with the St. Louis Rams for 2 days, and I was with the New England Patriots for like 2 weeks, and he was my offensive coordinator. He, every time I seen the guy, I quit. So, yeah, I think you're right there.
But the point is, the only time he's ever worked for anybody besides Belichick was in St. Louis when he was the offensive coordinator for a very short amount of time, and then he got fired.
Yeah, I mean, but some of these guys have only worked in under of one coach or in certain, like, you know, one places. Like,
If we had a researcher, he would be able to tell us who's the most successful head coach who only, for the most part, worked for one head coach throughout his career before he got that job. I would say it's probably a small list.
Probably Belichick. It's probably Belichick worked for Parcells and then himself.
No.
Which would deplete your entire argument. Hang on, let me do some quick research here. I'm making that up, but yeah. You do the research. I'm gonna give you another name since we're on the assistant coach wave. Eric Bieniemy, offensive coordinator, Kansas City Chiefs.
So I did a little bit of research because I know Bieniemy has been one of the popular names. And so I know a bunch of guys in the Chiefs. Actually, four out of the five starting linemen for the Chiefs on offense previous to this last couple weeks, because they got some injuries that came back healthy, were former Cleveland Browns players that I played with. Cam Irving was the left tackle.
Yep.
Andrew Wiley was the starting left guard.
Schwartzy.
Mitchell Schwartz was the right tackle, and then the center was Austin Ryder. So four out of those five guys I played with in Cleveland. But anyways, so I was asking him about
Ryder, like, was the guy who used to shower facing the wrong direction.
Wow, that's a random tidbit. I love it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I asked him about,
get the conversation going. Go ahead.
I asked him about Bieniemy, and they were like, super smart guy. He's much more of a rah-rah type guy, which me as like an old head, I probably wouldn't love it. But being that the team in Cleveland has a bunch of young players, a rah-rah college type guy might actually be pretty good because right. they're used to that from college and they're going to respond to that early on in your career. Whereas later on in your career, you have a wife and a family and you're like, you can't tell me anything that's going to be more motivating than going home to my three-year-old that right. I'm like, I need to be able to buy you diapers next week. So I don't want to get fired and shame on my entire family and right. humiliate you. Like, this is so much more important than any rah-rah speech. And so, you know, I'm kind of here nor there on the rah-rah, but for a young team, it could be good.
I like Bienemy. And even for the reasons you talked about being a rah-rah guy, I think they need a guy in there that sometimes you got to have someone in there that can kick your ass, right? Like, you want to be a tough guy. We can get as tough as we want, but we're going to get the work done. And if you want to take it to a level like, you know, yelling on the sideline and, you know, let's get behind closed doors and I want you lock you in office and want to see you actually do that. Because I don't know if anybody remembers Eric Bieniemy as a player, but that dude was a wild, crazy SOB. So I actually like Bieniemy. All right, now I'm going to go to former head coaches in the NFL. I got a couple more. I got a bunch of names. This is actually a segment we didn't produce, and I'm just rattling them off now. I got Ron Rivera, which is going to be a hot name for a lot of people in Cleveland for a lot of reasons. He's on the market. He's probably going to get a lot of opportunities, been a successful head coach. And I have Jim Caldwell as well. Give me your thoughts on either one of those guys.
So Jim Caldwell, I like him as a coach, but I think he would do better with a veteran-laden roster.
Okay. Yeah.
I look at him as he's a guy that he's a very smart offensive mind. He's good at developing quarterbacks, but as far as being a CEO of an entire roster of young players where you need to like develop him and keep your thumb on those guys every single day.
Okay.
I don't know.
You don't know.
So there's a big unknown there.
Look at some Jim Caldwell numbers while you continue.
Yeah. I would say Ron Rivera. Here's the one name that's going to be really popular, but I don't think he's a good fit in Cleveland. He's another guy to me that would do really well in a veteran organization with a bunch of old heads because he's a very steady guy. He's not like super tough and discipline minded. Like,
have you ever seen video of Ron Rivera at halftime? I would implore you to go look up Ron Rivera okay. in the locker room.
I'll look it up.
Cause I think it would change. Cause he's very mild mannered. He's, you know, soft spoken. He's respectful in his press conferences. But when you watch, I've seen videos of him at halftime of talking to his team. You could tell he's a former NFL football player. Cause that's what it seems like. He talks to them in that way. You know what I mean? Like, yo, get your head out of your ass. You're getting pushed around. Stop getting pushed around. Like, you know, like it's, he gets after it. Like it surprised me when I seen the video. Cause I had the same thought about him in my mind.
So part of that take is because I was asking Steve Smith about him because Steve worked for him and Steve kind of had the same take as me. He's like, you know, he's really good for a veteran roster, but there's with young guys, like I go back to young guys, they just need somebody to have their thumb on them all the time because they're squirrely, right? They're immature and they're full of the know-it-alls and they need a little bit tougher coach, I think. And he's like, Ron is good with that stuff, but not always as consistent as you would want.
So maybe. So tell me this. Is that a deficiency in the roster? If you have that kind of roster where you have nothing but young guys who are uncontrollable, is that a roster you can actually win?
They're not uncontrollable. You just got to get the right person. It's like a dog that's going to listen to anybody.
Okay.
It doesn't matter how sweet and soft you talk to them. They're going to listen to you versus a dog that's a rough dog or, if I'm sure you've done a lot of breaking of horses
growing up
out in a ranch. Like if you've got a horse that doesn't want to listen to anybody, you got to be harder on them in order to get them to listen and before you can harness them and everything. I've never ridden a horse in my life, but that's what I've heard. And so you just got to find the right trainer for the roster. And I think it's easy to say like, oh yeah, everybody would want a roster full of 28 to 32 year olds that were all Pro Bowlers, but that's just not the reality of the NFL. You're going to have some rosters that are older, some rosters that are younger, and you just need to kind of find the right staff that would fit that roster that you have.
Okay, so I'm going to rewind back to Jim Caldwell really quick. Jim Caldwell has been a head coach in the NFL for 7 seasons in the NFL, Joe. Can you guess how many were losing seasons?
Probably one, and that was the one that he got fired in Indy.
Two losing seasons. He started off in Indy 09 and 10 with Peyton Manning. They went 14-2, 10-6. Peyton Manning got hurt. They went 2-14, which set him up for Andrew Luck. They fired him.
Yeah, and then he got fired.
Brought the new coach in. He got hired in Detroit in 2014, 3 years later. So it took him 3 years to get back to a head coaching job. His first year in Detroit in 2014, they went 11-5, went to the playoffs, lost to the Cowboys. The next year, they went 7-9, which was his second losing season, right? And it's one of those close losing seasons. That's the best season you and I have ever had together. And then 2016, he went 9-7. 2017, he went 9-7, and he got fired. And now Patricia is there, and Patricia, I think, has 9 wins total in his 2 seasons in Detroit. And they fired him after going 3 or 4 seasons as winning teams. So he has a win percentage of like 55%, which is a pretty good winning percentage. I just think Caldwell deserves an opportunity because every organization he's been with, he's had more losing seasons. I mean, more winning seasons than losing seasons. He's five winning seasons, 2 losing.
I've always said that I thought Jim Caldwell got the rawest deal ever because Peyton Manning gets hurt. And you get fired because Peyton got hurt. Okay, right. Thanks a lot. That's my fault that the entire organization was built around one player and then he ended up getting injured.
Right.
And then in Detroit, he was nothing but successful and they got rid of him. Yeah. An organization that had nothing but shit forever for it's 2 decades since Barry Sanders was there in the 90s.
In the NFC North, 3 out of the 4 years to Aaron Rodgers, who was one of the best 20 quarterbacks in NFL history.
Yeah, I agree, man. I think he did a great job in Detroit. I think the 2 things that work against him, 1, his age. He's an older coach because he has been around forever. And for the most part, everybody's looking for the young and sexy coach. There's a few that hire older coaches, but for the most part, they want the young ones. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is he is a little bit like Ron Rivera in the media. He's very measured. He's not like a yeller and a screamer. And so the perception is that, you're not a tough guy and you don't really know what you're talking about because your success came in Indy when Tony Dungy retired and you took over a roster that was already loaded. That was a Super Bowl talent roster.
I will say as a college coach, he sucked. He went 23-63 at Wake Forest. So there could be something to the young guy, which leads me to my next group of guys. I'm going to give them all in one and not go one by one because we can't be on this podcast all night, even though people are clamoring to see what the coaching carousel looks like. I'm going to go with the college guys. There's 4 names that I have written down. I have Urban Meyer. I have Matt Campbell. I have Lincoln Riley. And I have Matt Rule. Those are the 4 college names that I have on the list. Any of those stick out to you?
I don't love the college coach going to the NFL because it is a very different game. And what makes you successful as a college coach is not necessarily what makes you successful as an NFL coach. Typically, college coaches are very successful because they're excellent recruiters. Mm-hmm. So they have excellent talent. And then once the talent is there, they're excellent at motivating them with rah-rah. Like that's why most of the like Dabo Sweeney, Pete Carroll, like a lot of those names that have had tons of success in college because you got a bunch of 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds that are ADD, that are just thinking about where they can go and get a free cup of beer that night. Mm-hmm. And to be able to keep them focused for 12 or 13 games every year is a real challenge. They don't have any other strings attached to them. And so it's easy for a college kid to just mail it in 1 week. Oh, I got exams this week. Oh, I got a couple dates I don't want to mess up. And so the priorities are always changing. And to keep the focus of a 19-year-old is very challenging. Uh-huh. Whereas like we talked about in the NFL, we're adults. We have families. Like those are our priorities. And so being the best professional possible is really important to us. And so the motivation more often comes from within. And so the one guy I would say on that list that would be interesting to me is Urban Meyer because he strikes me as a CEO type head coach, whereas those other guys are successful because they've got sexy little offenses and you know they've done good things, but for the most part they're winning because their talent is just so far superior to all the other teams, and they're getting the most out of that talent with motivational quotes and speeches and doing silly gadgety type stuff that just doesn't play in an NFL locker room. My drawback with Urban Meyer, because I think he would be tough and accountable and he'd make the guys respect him. My drawback is he doesn't have NFL experience. And so is he just going to hire a bunch of college coaches to try to come and coach NFL guys, which doesn't always work. More times than not, it doesn't work because the pro coaches are like, yo, the coaching style that you had in college doesn't play. Like, we're adults, we're professionals. Right. There's a lot of things that you don't know because you're only working with a college kid 2 or 3 hours a day in college. Mm-hmm. In the NFL, you're working with your guys 10 to 12 hours a day. And then the other concern that I would have is you're going to hire Urban Meyer. He's going to be there for 2 or 3 years, and then he's going to have a health condition and he's going to go leave and go take the next best job somewhere else.
Right.
And so what type of commitment are you going to get from him is almost my biggest concern with Urban Meyer.
I also don't think Urban Meyer works well with John Dorsey. Joe, what is it going to take for you to endorse me as the next head coach of the Cleveland Browns?
I've already done that. I've been okay. waiting. So my one was Brian Daboll. My one B was okay. Andrew Hawkins.
I appreciate it. All right. I'll be awaiting my phone call from the Haslams any minute now to offer me the job, in which I will demand control of the roster, 3 parking spots. I want the Jim Browns conference room changed in my name and honor.
Well, it's empty. All they'll have to do is change the nameplate. It'll be all right. There's no paperwork and there's no computer in there.
I only want to work 3 days a week. That's off the rip, off straight. Mm-hmm. I have other jobs that I'm not leaving. So I'm going to do all those jobs. I'm going to work at the NFL Network uninterrupted, continue the podcast, as well as coach the Cleveland Browns. Those are just a few of my demands. Declaration in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, Eminem's R candy bar. Soda back in the facility. You know what? When the Haslams came and I signed with Cleveland, there was always actually Mountain Dew in the facility. And I would always get a Mountain Dew from the refrigerator on the way home. And Mrs. Haslam.
Why were you drinking a Mountain Dew on the way home?
Because I'm addicted to Mountain Dew. Was this your first time meeting me or something? I'm Andrew Hawkins.
I'm setting you up because I used to always go to the Browns facility on the way home after I'd do my ice tub at like 6 o'clock at night, and I'd pour a tall boy coffee and I'd finish it off with a double espresso because I knew the worst and most stressful part of my day was coming up when you had to go home and deal with kids at bedtime. And I needed that energy boost because I was super tired after a long day of practice, which I usually watched, but working out and meetings and stuff. But I needed that energy to deal with the kids when I got home.
You needed the performance enhancer to be a dad. But Mrs. Haslam removed all the soda from the facility.
Oh,
and that was the moment I realized it was time to retire. If I didn't have access to soda for 9 hours a day, I'm like, how is this going to work? So she wanted to make everything healthier, which she did. And by getting rid of me, she made the team healthier just by that move. All right, guys, that does it for this episode of the Tomahawk Show. Joe, you have any final thoughts, man?
Yeah, final thoughts. It is NFL's Black Monday. It's always a little bit sobering because for a lot of teams, if you're not in the playoffs, you're either going home and the season's over, and it's a lot of wondering about what the offseason and the next season's going to bring. Or for a lot of coaches, it's the end of your dream of something that you've dreamed of since maybe the moment you got into coaching, and that was being a head coach. And the unfortunate news that you're losing your job and you're going to have to move your family. It's always difficult, but for the franchises that didn't really love their coach, it's an opportunity to have new beginnings. It's like the spring. It's like May when those flowers, those tulips finally erupt from the frozen soil of Wisconsin's barren earthen sub-zero temperatures, and they develop into a beautiful red flower. For those fan bases, probably the Cleveland Browns, maybe the Dallas Cowboys, it's a good day. And it's a day of looking forward into the future.
You know what? I'm a glass half full kind of guy. I don't call it Black Monday anymore. I call it hashtag free money Monday. All right. Mailbox money. Hashtag mailbox money Monday. We'll use that on Twitter, Joe. Joe, you have any New Year's Eve plans?
I'm actually going out to the Rose Bowl to watch Wisconsin take on Oregon, the Oregon Ducks.
So you'll be out in my neck of the woods.
To LA. I'll be out in your neck of the woods. Hopefully you've got a little extra cot that I can snuggle up on and bring my family over to the house. Maybe ditch the kids.
Absolutely.
And go have a few Mountain Dews at the local pub.
I would love to give all of you the flu. I look forward to it, Joe. All right, listen, we'll be back next Sunday for Wild Card Weekend. We also have a holiday best of special coming your way. So check your feed for that because it's going to be awesome. All the best moments of the Tomahawk this year in one jam-packed episode. We could also be recording a playoff preview show with Joe as he comes to LA, as you just heard. So we will work out the logistics and get you all the Tomahawk content that your little orange mouth desires. Joe, take us out.
Joe Hawk yourself.